I'm going to be very careful on the podcast today. It's just me, by the way. Merrick is back tomorrow. I'm going to be very careful on the podcast today. I don't want to say the wrong thing. I would hate for Francesco Aquilini to sick his legal team on me like he sicked it on the Globe and Mail in the province. If you haven't heard, the owner of the Vancouver Canucks sent sort of a cease and desist letter and asked for an apology because these two media publications had the moxie, just the bravery, the balls, the cojones to claim that it was Aquilini's decision to hire John Tortorella when it is, in fact, in his mind, Mike Gillis's decision. Now, here's the thing. Gillis said right from the top that it was his decision. Okay, but that's exactly what you expect a general manager to say. He also said that Aquilini was there during the process. The Aquilini family was there during the hiring process. So you get the sense that maybe, just maybe, they were auditioning coaches for ownership and ownership would have picked the coach they liked the most. Ah, and then what happens? Let's see here. Well, then you have a situation where if the ownership says, oh, I like this guy better than the others, well, then what are you going to do if that's the guy who signs your checks? I mean, what do you do? Say no? Say no, that's not what we're going to do? Of course not. You're going to hire that guy, right? So this idea that Aquilini didn't have anything to do with the hiring of John Tortorella, I don't buy it. And I also don't like the idea of him sending out these legal messages to try to silence the media. But even more than any of this, what is the deal? Like, think about this for a second. The owner of the Vancouver Canucks has given a 5-year contract to a coach. He is now past year one. There are 4 years left. From the tone of the Trevor Linden press conference today, you get the sense that Tortorella will be retained. And if not, well, then you know, they're going to bring in another coach. But I don't know. Okay, I guess what I'm trying to say is, if the coach comes back, which again, it sounds like Tortorella will next year, why wouldn't you take ownership of that hiring if you're the owner of the team? Like, aren't we all trying to just cover our own bases here? Isn't he basically saying, listen, let's make sure that the guy I just fired for doing a shitty job gets assigned the blame if this thing doesn't work out? Is that really the direction you want to take from a public relations standpoint? I mean, isn't it a de facto vote of non-confidence or unconfidence in your coach if the owner is sending cease and desist letters to media claiming that the owner was the guy who hired the coach? It's a very strange situation. I'll say this. Linden was very good in his press conference. We hopped on the air about 3/4 of the way done. And I liked it. I liked what I heard. I especially liked the idea that this guy has sought out advice from other franchise icons who returned to their teams and did well, or in Yzerman's case, went to Tampa and did well. He talked to Cam Neely. He talked to Yzerman. He talked to Sakic. Neely's a guy who always seems to get passed over when we have these conversations about the franchise icons going back to serve their teams well. And he's done a hell of a job there, too. Clashing sometimes with Claude Julien, but never got to the point where those guys couldn't work together. So I like that answer. Read it between the lines. It sounds like Tortorella is going to stay. As far as the general manager goes, well, that's going to be an interesting one. He said that they're going to look in-house potentially. Well, that's good news for Lawrence Gilman, who was retained by ownership after Gillis was fired. And it sounds like he might have his hat in the ring for potentially becoming the general manager. Wouldn't that be exciting? He said they'll also look outside the organization. That makes you try to think, well, what's that going to be? The immediate speculation when Gillis was fired yesterday was that they go out and get Jay Feaster, but I hope that's not the case. I mean, we all know Tortorella and Feaster get along, but you really hope that's not the case. I am not exactly the biggest Jay Feaster fan. But I guess the thing that I want to figure out, and Harrison Mooney is going to join us on the show today to give us a Vancouver perspective on these proceedings, is does the PR coup help? You know, does Trevor Linden coming back and being the face of this franchise, are there warm fuzzies? Or is Vancouver at a point where you'd rather see somebody come in with more of an established track record? Because like we talked about yesterday, it's interesting when these moves are made, when the franchise icon comes back to the team, because it's usually when the team is at its lowest point. Now, Vancouver's not at its lowest point, I don't think. I mean, you feel shitty not making the playoffs, and you're wondering what the future is going to look like because you have an aging roster and a lot of money tied up into people and not a lot of youth on the team and all that stuff. But it's not as if they were in the same spot as Buffalo. It's not as if they were in the same spot as Colorado, you know, when Sakic and LaFontaine were hired. So it's interesting to see whether or not they did the sort of the PR move here at a time when the franchise needs it. Probably. I mean, I don't know. I don't know if it needs it. I don't know if this franchise and this fan base would have preferred someone with more experience running a team to come in versus a franchise icon. But I guess that's a question for Canucks fans. And again, these things have a shelf life. You know, if the Canucks come out next year and they're worse than they were this year, well, then what? Then the shine's off, right? Then what do you got? You got a president who's inexperienced trying to dig you out of a deeper hole. The minute Bob Nicholson's name was thrown into the fray, that's the guy that I was really hoping they'd go with, to be honest with you. I was really intrigued by that. One of the smartest hockey men around, 20 years of service to Hockey Canada, a guy who could run both the business side and also contribute on the hockey ops side. That's the guy I kind of wanted to see. You talk about a franchise, all of a sudden the rudder has fallen off, and it is spiraling down the whirlpool. Well, you'd like a steadier hand at the wheel than the guy who's never done it before. And I thought that Bob Nicholson would have been a really good choice. And I didn't hear this question asked, but I wonder if there were substantive conversations that didn't lead to him taking the job, or if it had always been Trevor Linden. Because the way that Boschrod was writing about it yesterday, it seems like it's always been Trevor Linden, that Linden knew when he went on the air yesterday on that TV show and denied it that it was going to be him. So mayhaps the Nicholson stuff was a little bit overblown. But yeah, it's you know, overall, I think a good day for Vancouver hockey. Getting Linden back gives the franchise a jolt of different energy. But it really does depend on who his brain trust is. It really does depend on who his brain trust is. And that'll be where the first judgment comes down. But back to Akelini, he was asked a question about the style of play. He'd like to see the Vancouver Canucks play, and he kind of just acquiesced to whatever Trevor Linden said in the press conference, which is probably the smart idea, the smart decision on his part. But he says it is going to be Trevor's show. Hockey ops are his bag, baby. Ain't no Akelini interference on hockey ops. Which is obviously the right thing to say when everyone thinks you interfered with hockey ops last summer and the team ended up with John Tortorella. I will point out something that our friend Jason Bro brought up from Pro Hockey Talk on Twitter this morning about the style of play. And I'm as guilty as anyone of assigning the Canucks' current style of play to John Tortorella. But Bro found an article from Elliot Friedman last year that did kind of indicate that as the playoffs started last season, the Canucks were playing a different style of hockey. Grittier, less offensive, kind of more conservative, bring the forwards back in the defensive zone when they played better teams. So this mindset, at the very least, predates John Tortorella. And so I wonder this. I still think that Gillis got a raw deal in some ways, and I still think that ultimately the coaching decision and the stylistic decisions are influenced by what ownership wants this team to be. No question about that. The idea that Akelini's hands don't have some blood on them on this situation, I don't buy for a second. But I do wonder whether there was a crisis of conscience that we've seen before in this league that befell the Vancouver Canucks. And by that I mean, everybody remembers how things went down with Washington. Freewheeling, high-flying team, Bruce Boudreau leading this team to massive point totals in the standings, and then when the playoffs started, they'd fall apart. And the thought was that you couldn't play that style and succeed any longer. Now, I don't know if you could say the same thing about Vancouver, because that style was very successful. But maybe they felt like, at some point, that in order to get over the hump, to get back to where they wanted to be, they had to play a different way, and that notion just pervaded all the decisions they made. So maybe the philosophy changed before Tortorella got there. Maybe Tortorella was a symptom of the philosophy. Either way, the takeaway from the Linden presser this morning, I think, is that Tortorella is going to stay. Aquilini says hands off. And Linden came across as a good face of the organization, which is sometimes what you need to change the conversation. There's some heavy lifting left, trying to figure out what to do with that roster. Because the biggest decision that Linden has to make is whether he's keeping Tortorella, and if he's keeping Tortorella, what do you have to do to that roster to make it work, to make it work for the style that you want to play? Because that's really the issue with Tortorella coming on this year and the team not being successful, is that you get the feeling that there are a bunch of guys in that roster wired to play a certain way, and Tortorella wants them to play another way, and they can't. So we shall see. I don't know. It's Vancouver's a very interesting situation. I think they made a positive move today with Linden, but we'll see how the whole thing goes. Coming up on the show today, Harrison Mooney on the Vancouver Canucks. Coming up on the show today, Jody Shelley talking about the Columbus Blue Jackets and really just a wonderful little story that's being cooked up in Columbus right now. I mean, we were worrying a couple weeks ago about them not being able to close the deal. Clearly they can close the deal. Well, not, you know, the easiest route. Giving up the Ekman Larson goal in the final minute was kind of tough, but they got the goal they needed, and now it looks like they're going to be a playoff team, so we'll talk to Jody Shelley about that later in the show. Plus, going postal, it's just me today, so expect a multitude of wrestling, food, and Smashing Pumpkins questions. Anyway, that is the intro that we do, and now let's start the show proper, shall we? We start the Greg Wyshynski Show proper, shall we?
Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Well, again, listen, you're one of my favorite guests. I appreciate you coming on the program.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Dude, I know. Listen, I wish I could spend like a full hour or more on the podcast.
Debate hockey, pop culture, and more hockey. Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Master Ninja theme song. So there it is, ladies and gentlemen. Mooney coming up in a second or two. Really, I want to talk about this Halak thing for a second with Oates, but maybe we should do that after Mooney comes on, because I'm going to need some runway for that. But if you want to chime in on the Canucks stuff, go ahead, at Wyshynski or puckdaddyblog@yahoo.com, because obviously there's a lot to be said there. Evidently, Aquilini won't answer why the Canucks fired Mike Gillis. Not a surprise there. Again, go ahead and sue everybody for writing what they think happened or what they understand to have happened, but don't actually tell the story, right? Like, it's easier to just throw your lawyers around than actually coming clean and explaining yourself. The idea that a guy would ask for an apology from a newspaper for writing something that a multitude of sources have indicated is true, but he won't come out and just explain it, the blow-by-blow of it, it's farcical. But that's what, you know, that's what rich guys do, right? I expect Merrick is going to start being like that, too. He's got that TV money. Real quick, Wyatt Arndt writes so that Linden was actually asked, how long are you going to be president of this team? That was actually a question from somebody in the Vancouver media. How long are you going to be president of this team? That is the greatest thing I've ever read. All right. Joining us now on the line is Harrison Mooney. He of Puck Daddy, passes the Bulis, roughly 17 other jobs, and he joins us now. Was that actually a question that was asked at the press conference, Harrison?
Yes. Yes, it was.
How long are you going to be president? Wow. That's amazing.
I think there are some genuine concerns about how committed Trevor Linden actually is to this job, considering he wanted nothing to do with the Canucks right up until yesterday.
And then he lied on TV.
Well, there was that too, but he apologized for it. And so now we're already calling it a white lie. We love Trevor Linden. We love him.
Well, let me ask you about that. I mean, you have your finger on the pulse of cynical Canucks fans. What is the reaction to Linden? I mean, from where I'm sitting, it's obviously a PR move to get a franchise icon in that seat. But there's also a part of me that believes that maybe there are Canucks fans that are happy to have a fresh voice in the conversation, too.
Yeah, I mean, well, there've always kind of been, to borrow a term here from Kevin Lowe, there have always been two tiers of Canucks fans. basically you have the ones that are like really plugged in, the diehards. They listen to the radio every day. They read all the blogs, all the papers. They have certain columnists they like and don't like. That group is a cynical bunch. And that group, they're not overly happy with this move today because, yes, it seems like a PR grab. The team tends to lose, and they also tend to kind of ruin the reputations of people that come through. So Trevor Linden is our one good thing, you know? He's unblemished, he's spotless, he's adorable, and he's just so handsome. And so it's a little concerning for him to be in this position because, I mean, you know, here's a guy who, you know, played through broken ribs in the Stanley Cup final, and we'll never forget that. But you know who else played through broken ribs in the Stanley Cup final? Kevin Lowe. And I think that the idea that Trevor Linden could become Kevin Lowe over the next however many years is terrifying. So that's that group. The other group, they just really like Trevor Linden. And hey, look, it's Trevor Linden. Let's buy some tickets.
He is a very handsome man. When I saw him at the press conference today, he reminded me of the older gentleman that you see in Cinemax softcore films.
He looks a little bit like Daniel Day-Lewis as Lincoln, like a handsome, stately Lincoln, you know? The Lincoln we all kind of imagine.
And he's putting together a cabinet, so it's a perfect comparison. speaking of that, what would you like to see happen with the general manager position for this team?
Well, what would be awesome is if they just hired all the other members of the 1994 team, you know, as like a think tank, like the manatees in that one South Park episode, the right Family Guy episode. But no, I think what'll probably happen is they'll bring in somebody who's a little more experienced. And I mean, the other possibility is they might even just wind up promoting Lawrence Gilman. Right. You know, I do think that they understand, you know, that Trevor Linden isn't the most experienced hockey mind. Obviously, he played the game, and that's wonderful. But he has no experience as a front office guy. And so I think that bringing in, say, you know, I mean, Marcus Naslund's name has been bandied about. I think that'd be a really bad idea. They'll probably wind up bringing in, you know, a fairly experienced kind of old school guy.
Why would Naslund be a bad idea?
Well, I mean, I don't know that it would be a bad idea, but you know, he's got a couple years of GMing experience with Modo over in Sweden, and that's all well and good. But I don't know if you can really hand the Canucks over to, you know, two guys who don't really have that much front office experience here. I know they're former players. I mean, they're both up in the rafters. That's lovely. But, you know, the Canucks are facing some pretty tricky moves here. I think it's going to take a pretty savvy, experienced hockey mind to get them out from under all these no-trade clauses and, you know, some of their cap issues and, you know, really rebuild the prospect cupboard. And I just don't know that you want to turn that over to, you know, two former players who are still pretty young.
Yeah, indeed. The Gilman thing's interesting because it seems like, and this happens a lot with like the second in command, right? Whether it's assistant coaches or assistant GMs or whoever, it seems like everyone's like, you know, Mike Gillis made some really terrible decisions, but all the contracts are really good, and that was obviously Gilman's bag. Why does he emerge unscathed from the mismanagement of Mike Gillis?
Yeah, I mean, that's a big part of it. You know, Gilman has really kind of been touted as the, you know, the contract guy, the savvy negotiator. Pretty much any time there's a big move, you find out that it was actually Gilman working the phones. You know, there was that rumor that Roberto Luongo's agent had been the one that really negotiated that deal to Florida, but eventually it was reported it was actually Gilman just hauling ass on the phone for about 24 hours to get that deal done. So I think, you know, people have really liked just kind of his raw work. And obviously when Gillis is the face and he's kind of this like grumpy, sleepy-eyed face, it's a little bit easier to hate him and then like the, you know, relatively handsome, savvy man behind him that seems to do all the work.
You are so obsessed with aesthetics. I mean, I get the feeling that if they had hired David Beckham to run the team right now, everybody would be head over heels.
Absolutely. No, I think it matters. I actually do. You know, Trevor Linden is he's a studly dude. You know, out here in Vancouver, I mean, he's one of those guys. I'll tell you, like one time, Justin Trudeau, you may not know who that is there in the America.
Oh, no, I do. But, yeah.
Okay. Justin Trudeau is like a very handsome man. And one day he came through the Vancouver Sun newsroom and I saw like the back of his head and it was like, wow, that is a handsome back of a man's
head. You know, You bring up a great point because, like, Lou Lamoriello looks like a mob boss, and I think everybody has confidence in a mob boss. George McPhee kind of looks like Morrissey, and I think people are always like, well, that fits the sullen, depressed, hopeful, but ultimately crushed vibe of the Washington Capitals. I wonder if there is something to the GM taking upon or looking like the fortunes of the team. It's quite possible.
Well, I think that... Like, your figure, I mean, because Trevor Linden, he's a figurehead at this point. Like, let's be honest. What this is Francesco Aquilini fires Gillis. It's pretty clear that I don't want to say he hired the coach because I'll get a text saying I'm a prick. But, you know, it's pretty clear that he's calling a lot of the shots. But people don't really like Francesco Aquilini. So here's what he does. He turns all of that over to handsome Trevor Linden. And now instead of this, you know, grumpy man that people dislike, you have... You know, the studly warrior of the 1994 almost cup winners. And yes, that handsome face is now the face of the Canucks. And I actually do think the aesthetics matter here for that reason.
Let's say that there was a general manager named Pike Millis. And they interviewed a coach named Johan Montarella. And there was an owner named Francisco Smacadini. Do you think Smacadini had a lot to do with Mortadella being hired by, I forget the first name?
In this hypothetical situation where three names very similar to the three names that we know are real people, made this decision. Yeah, I think, Mike Gillis had a direction he wanted to go. And then I think that his boss sat down and said, so what's the direction you're thinking? Cause I'm thinking Tortorella. And Gillis said, well, I'm thinking this John Stevens guy is pretty good. And then Aquilini said, yeah, I agree. Tortorella is pretty good.
but you do agree. I mean, like we were talking about before you hopped on, like there were sort of inklings that the Canucks were headed towards this more conservative defensive direction even before Tortorella got hired. So I don't know where that comes from. I don't know if he was a symptom of that or if that style of play comes down from ownership. I don't know, and that's the thing that bothers me most about it is like someone just give us the goddamn truth. Like just someone say, you know, this is how it went down and we'll all be cool with it. But the idea, there were so many people leaking that Aquilini made the call on Tortorella. I don't know if it's because they're trying to protect Gillis, but who wants to protect Gillis? He's not everybody's favorite. I don't know where it comes from, but the idea that, like, again, that Aquilini is going to try to sue newspapers for saying he hired the current coach who probably will be back next year is insane. It's someone saying, it's not my problem that's coming back next year. It's someone else's problem that's coming back next year.
Yeah, no, it's really frustrating, actually, because, you know, I think it was Ed Willis with the Province that originally reported, you know, that this Tortorella was an ownership hire. And the next day, he had to print a retraction because he got a call from the Aquilini saying, no, that's not the case. But what's happened is that's never gone away. And other people have reported it. Other people have reported it through sources close to the situation. And then you wind up with a situation where it's kind of become fact. But then when two guys report it this week, Aquilini threatens to sue them for libel, texts one of them that he's a prick. And then you get this weird thing that he said in the press conference where it's like, oh, well, you know, Tortorella was Gillis's hire, and I have to take responsibility for that. Like, what does that mean? So it's really confusing. It's tough to know who did anything, and it's tough to know how they feel about Tortorella because it kind of seems like they chose him over Gillis. But then at the same time, you know, if they're embarrassed at being linked to that hire, you wonder why they would distance themselves.
Yeah, indeed. What would you do, you know, what would be your first couple moves if you were going to take over the Canucks? I mean, is it a case where you want to get younger? Is it a case where you need more guys to fit the style they're playing? What would you do?
Well, I guess if I'm Linden, the first thing I do is learn how to do the job. And then, yeah, you know, after that, I mean, I honestly think that the smart thing to do is get rid of the Sedins and Bieksa probably. You know, these guys are your leadership core. Is you sit down with them and you get a sense of what they're really feeling. Because they've put on a really brave face. You know, they've said all the right things. They boosted Tortorella. They've all taken responsibility for it. But those are things you say to the media because you hate the media. Now you're sitting down with, you know, a guy who you played with. And he's trying to get a sense of the direction of this team. And these guys are smart guys that have opinions. So I honestly think that he should sit down, get a sense of what they feel about this year. And then after that, you have to find a GM that is the right fit for this organization. And that's somebody who actually comes in with a plan for how he's going to fix it, as opposed to another guy that says, oh, I'm going to learn on the job and surround myself with the right people.
Yeah, indeed. All right, Mr. Mooney, thank you for joining us. Anything you'd like to add about the hiring of Trevor Linden, sir?
No, not really. But again, I just want to point out that he is so handsome, and he probably smells like warm chestnut.
I disagree, sir. I look at Trevor Linden, and I see a man that smells like bark. The bark of a mighty elm.
Awesome.
Can elms be mighty? I probably should have gone with oak there. In
well,
hindsight.
I mean, there are probably some mighty elms. The
I'll
mightiest
say.
Elm.
Indeed. The West Elm. All right, let me let you go. You got it right, shit. So thanks for joining us, sir, and good luck during the Linden era.
Hey, thanks for having me.
However long that era may last. I mean, for God's sakes, how long are you going to be president? It's like the most Canuckiest question by a Canuck media person I've ever read. Going postal later, so let's now, before we welcome Jody Shelley on the podcast, let's talk about Yaroslav Halak, Adam Oates, Alan Walsh, and this mess. Now, Alan Walsh talked to Katie Carrera of the Washington Post today to say that Yaro never at any time said he didn't want to start against St. Louis. Now, let's take you back to yesterday. Yaroslav Halak does not play against the St. Louis Blues. Brandon Holtby does. The Capitals win the game, stay alive, although they can be eliminated tonight. The story that Adam Oates tells is that Halak asked not to play against the St. Louis Blues because he wasn't comfortable facing the Blues because the Blues are his former team. Now, as we talked about, this is not too out of the realm of possibility for a goalie. Ryan Miller didn't play against Buffalo. Whether it was his decision or his coach's decision, he didn't play. Despite the fact you'd expect a goaltender to up his game, be more focused, whatever you want to say, against his former team. Show them up, that whole thing. It's a classic sports trope. So, Halak doesn't play. And then Walsh the next day comes out and says, Yaro never at any time said he didn't want to start against St. Louis. He continues by saying, the discussion between player and coach should have remained private. Quote, I am bewildered that a coach would break that trust. Now, here are two separate issues. The first being, did Yaroslav Halak not want to play against the St. Louis Blues? I tend to believe Adam Oates here, because why would a coach possibly say this to the media were it not true? I've only worked with Adam Oates for about a year and a half. I don't know him all that well. I get the feeling he's not a pathological liar. I don't understand why a coach would say a player didn't want to play against the team unless the player told him, I don't want to play against the team, or I'd rather not face these guys. Because to do the other thing would be to make up something about one of your players, tell the media about it, and completely impugn that player's reputation going forward. So why? Why would he do that? He wouldn't. I think there's an element of truth there. I don't know if it's lost in translation. I don't know what it is. But clearly there was something communicated from player to coach that he would rather not play in this game. I believe Oates there. Where Walsh is right, though, is when he says, I am bewildered that a coach would break that trust. As am I. And that's really the bottom line. You know, I was going back and forth with Aaron Portsline from the Columbus Dispatch earlier today and saying that I really did feel Oates was out of line going to the media with that explanation. And Portsline said, you know, as a great reporter would, don't you want the truth from a coach? Like, don't you want the truth to come out? Isn't that what we want from these coaches, for them to be candid about things? Well, yeah. Without question. We always want them to be candid. When we're sitting in a press conference listening to Adam Oates give us the, I don't know, for the 100,000th time as to why this team can't keep a lead, we would love for Adam Oates to be like, well, I think most of the blame goes to Mike Green. Yeah, we would love that. It would be great. But we don't get it. And I think a lot of times we don't get it when there are situations where players and coaches have conversations behind closed doors talking about why they don't want to play in a certain game, why they don't want to be on a certain line that we're not privy to. And I think this is one of them. I think this is a situation where he went to the Capitals and said, look, I'm not feeling right about this. Be all right if I didn't play. I think it gives you guys a better chance to win. That's essentially what he's saying, right? He's saying, I think it gives you guys a better chance to win if I don't play in this game. And Adam Oates decided to tell the media that Halak begged out. It doesn't do the Capitals any good. It doesn't do Halak any good. It doesn't do McPhee any good, who now looks like he traded for a quitter. It doesn't do anybody any good to share that with the media. So Walsh is right there. I'm bewildered that a coach would break that trust. I completely agree. Completely agree. And it just shows that in many ways that Oates is amateur hour when it comes to a lot of the aspects of head coaching that you need to be good at. Like earning the trust of your players by not throwing them under the bus, as he's done with Ovechkin and with Halak in the last couple weeks. This could be a function of a guy knowing he's probably got one skate out the door at this point. But it goes back to what I've said. I love the things that Adam Oates preaches insofar as special teams. I think he's been beneficial to some of the centers he's worked with. But as a head coach in this league, man, there's something lacking. It's lacking in the five-on-five play for these teams, and it's lacking in his communication with players. And I'll say this about the Capitals, though, not to let them off the hook. In both cases, Dale Hunter leaving, Adam Oates probably out of here. You have a situation where the coach basically seems like he's thrown up his hands and said, I don't know what to do with this group. That's essentially what Hunter was indicating when he left. So I don't know what to do with this group. I'm going to go back to junior. I don't know what I'm going to do, what I can do with this group. I'm going to throw Ovechkin under the bus and tell you all that Halak's a quitter. It's essentially what they're saying, right? So I don't know. It's not something I'd expect a coach to do. I think it's more damaging than anything else. And that's it about Halak. I also think we all know that Walsh jumps in because his client is going to be a UFA. And now his reputation has been damaged because of this situation. No question about that. So I don't know. It's a toughie. Moving on to last night. I was really, 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 really happy to see Columbus close the deal. You know, the Phoenix gets a point out of this thing to keep things interesting. They remain 2 points in back of the Dallas Stars for the final playoff spot in the Western Conference. Dallas has a huge tiebreaker advantage with 35 regulation wins. 3 games left for both, including Dallas and Columbus tonight in the game that will be started with Columbus having a 1-0 lead on a Nathan Horton goal. I know you've got 1,000 questions about that, which we'll try to get to later. So Phoenix stays 2 points back. They've got at Nashville, San Jose, and Dallas at home. Dallas goes Columbus at home, St. Louis at home, and then at Phoenix. So that whole situation's not settled. The East can be settled tonight. The East can be settled tonight. I think if Detroit and Columbus both win, then we are done. Washington out, New Jersey out. Detroit is in Pittsburgh for the return of Chris Letang after 10 weeks. Most amazing thing about the Letang thing, by the way, was when he had the stroke and it was reported that he had the stroke, they said 6 weeks. They became 10. Joining us down the line, he is a broadcaster and a man about town for the Columbus Blue Jackets. He is Jody Shelley, former NHL great, in my opinion. And he joined us here on the Merrick Wyshynski podcast. Hello, Jody. It's me, Greg Wyshynski. Merrick is off and about today. And thanks for joining us. Last night, the Columbus Blue Jackets showed me they can close the deal. And I think that's something that a lot of us were hoping we'd see out of this team, that it wasn't a team that could only beat Detroit, that it could also win very important games at very important times in the season. Is that something that you're confident they've shown you as well?
Well, yeah. I mean, they're a team that has shown me, as a fan of them for a long time, is that they have a strong identity. And all year we've this organization, this team has gone up against teams that say, before and after the game, they're hard to play against. And you know, that's really a big compliment in any level of sport. You want to be that guy, that team, that teams. Don't, I wouldn't say fear, but have that respect where you know it's going to be a hard-fought night if the team shows up. Now, the Jackets have had some pretty long stretches here, along with the rest of the league, where, and you've seen it throughout the league, where you'll catch a team when they're just at the end. They're exhausted. That the schedule has been so intense and so flat out with travel and back-to-back games and just emotional highs and lows with the teams you're playing against that you might catch a team on the off night. And the Jackets have had those situations throughout this past, we'll say, month. But there's been letdowns, one about 10 days ago in Long Island, where it was coming off a couple big games. They go to Long Island and really didn't show up. And then they had a couple days off from there and kind of reset, kind of another push. But last night showed you, yeah, that they understood what kind of situation they were in. They beat Long Island. They didn't play very well a couple nights ago, but they beat them 4-0. That was a big 2 points. And then last night, when you go into that situation, they almost felt tentative. I mean, Phoenix is a good hockey team, obviously. They're fighting for their lives. But I don't know if the Jackets were. Some people think they were tired. I'm not buying that. I think that they were a little tentative, maybe a little nervous. They weren't making their passes. They weren't paying attention to details. Nathan Horton got up. You know, he was sidelined last night, back out of the lineup. And the bench kind of got mixed up. And from there, Matty Calvert made a heck of a play on negating an icing. And from there, they created momentum. The building caught fire, and they rode it. And, yeah, it was a great combination to get that victory last night.
And then, obviously, Johansson with the big goal. He has 32 goals in the season, maybe above and beyond what we expected from him this season. But he's been a catalyst for them, man. Like, well, talk about the progression of this kid's season. And does he have captain material, you think?
That I don't know. He's a young kid. He definitely has a skill. He's a big guy. He's a great centerman. And I've seen him in this year. I've only been with the Blue Jackets organization as a broadcaster since the beginning of this year. And I've known Ryan personally on a kind of a different level. We would skate together in the off season. I live in Columbus. My wife is from there. So I would get ice, and then any of the young guys that wanted to skate that were in town training would skate with me. So I got to see this kid as, I mean, even younger guy, 18, 19-year-old kid, you know, just out of junior, supposed to be in junior, really. Training for the off season, and his skills through the roof. Big gangly kid when I first met him. Now he's more of a man. He's really grown into his body. He's a broad shouldered kid who knows how to use that. His hockey sense and his ability to read a play. And to me, the tremendous part about him is he slows the play down already. And if you think of a guy like Joe Thornton, when he gets the puck, guys back off. Unlike when I got the puck, I would get rushed. I don't know what it's like to be like Joe Thornton or Ryan Johansson. When you get the puck, people back off because they respect that you have so many things you can do with it. And Ryan is so creative. He can attack off the wall in the offensive zone. And he does things like last night in that moment in overtime when he got the puck on the offensive zone of the blue line. This is about the third time in the last, I don't know, 3 weeks that he scored a big game-winning goal. Clutch. And one was in Montreal a couple weeks ago where he has the puck in the offensive zone. And in Montreal, there was a defender in front of him, a defenseman named Carey Price. He put it in there. And last night it was the same situation where it was like, yes, this is where we want the ball. We want on the tee right here for Ryan Johansson. And to see him put that in and smile and the arena explode, he doesn't know how good he is. But in those situations, he's the guy on this team who you want to have the puck right now.
Yeah, and to break it down, he's got two overtime game winners. He's got three empty netters, so he's closing the deal. And one of my favorite, as anyone who listens to the podcast knows, one of my favorite stats is the first goal stat. The guy who scores the first goal in the game to set the tempo, and he's done that 8 times this year for Columbus to lead the Blue Jackets. So obviously,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. He's a pace setter, man. He comes out of that gate fast. The rest of the horses got to catch up.
I like the empty net stat too. I like that empty net stat because, as a teammate, if you have a guy with an empty net, I know it looks easy, all right, when they get to the red line and make that play, but to beat the guy and seal the deal instead of having that late period face-off in your own end, I don't mind those guys getting those empty netters at all.
It's one of the most misunderstood stats in hockey, Jody. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, Ovechkin was a guy who used to get maligned because his goal totals would be padded by empty net goals. But you're like, well, first off, think about why he's out there in that moment. You know, despite the fact that everybody thinks he's a giant defensive liability now. And think about what that does. It ends the game. It's a very important stat, and I think it gets confused sometimes because people just assume it's a cheap goal because there ain't nobody to defend it. But in actuality, it's a very important thing for the team. So that's,
well, let me elaborate on that. Last night, the Jackets got scored on late in the period, okay? They had the puck in the neutral zone. Mark Letestu had it on his stick but couldn't find a lane to throw it at the net. He threw it across the ice, across the neutral zone. And Phoenix comes back in and gets a face-off in the offensive zone. They go on to score and tie it up with 12 seconds left. So just think, if Ryan Johansson or someone else had that puck, not picking on Letestu, but in those moments, that's a big play. Get over the red line, hit the net, let's line up, get out of here.
On that Ekman-Larsson goal, which seemed to sail past 25 bodies without touching any of them, that was a ridiculous goal.
That was impressive, wasn't it? Yeah,
he's a hell of a player. Is there anybody on this roster who you think has dramatically improved from start of the season to now?
Well, we just spoke of one, Ryan Johansson, but another kid, and it's a young kid here, is Boone Jenner. I mean, and this kid is just out of junior, but he's a man, and he plays like a man. He handles himself like a pro. I believe the NHL is a game for men, no nonsense, you know, and that's how I came in, and I really love that about this game. And I think Boone Jenner has that old school captain, grizzled kind of Wendell Clark type about him. I really like the way he plays the game. He's got a fierce attitude when he's on the ice. He wants the puck, he wants to hit, he wants to skate, he wants to work. And he's just a farm boy from Ontario. And love having a guy like that around this, just as a rookie presence. I mean, and you talk about a 1-2 punch, him and Ryan Murray. And Ryan Murray has been a pro. I mean, I don't know if he's gotten better or he's been great from the start and he's remained consistent the whole season. That's the type of impact these two young kids have. But those guys, for me, have been very impressive with the way they've played, the way they've handled themselves. And another young guy, I'm telling you, this David Savard is a young, he wasn't on the depth chart, wasn't on the radar, really. Obviously, he was on the depth chart, but wasn't on the radar to make the team out of camp. And he's a guy they cannot take out of the lineup as a, I think he's a rookie. He played a few games last year. Rookie defenseman for the Columbus Blue Jackets. Those three guys, I'm just telling you, it's seamless what they've done. And you ask who's improved the most, I would say Boone Jenner. But it's exciting to talk about those guys and that kind of improvement and overall outlook for the Jackets.
Yeah, Savard definitely getting a bit more ice time late in the season now and playing pretty well. For those of us who may not get it, what do you like about what Todd Richards does with this team?
What he does here?
Yeah.
I like what he's done with this young group. You know, if you think about it, with a young group, you have to find different ways to get to them, different ways to motivate, maybe different ways to get to their level. And I think he's done a good job all season as taking things as they're handed to them and really learning from their lessons and moving on. He's a good coach. He's got some great things. He's got a great system here. Obviously, he's centered around Sergei Bobrovsky and the young talents around him. But just the way he treats his players, the way he gets the most out of them, and pretty much stays even keel. You know, Todd's a guy that played the game. He's got respect. He's been assistant coach. He's been a head coach for a few years now. And I just like the way he handles this overall group, and he's getting the most out of them for sure consistently.
How much would it mean for this? Well, we know for a fact, obviously, making the playoffs is a very big thing for this team, for this franchise, for this fan base. I've long said that you grow fans by having people live and die with you during a playoff run. But specifically, how much would it mean to this team and this franchise if they drew the Pittsburgh Penguins in the first round?
Well, I don't think they really care at this point who they get. Yeah, that would be exciting. I think the Rangers would be an even better matchup, and it's a little distant by somewhere. Two behind the Flyers right now. We'd have to catch the Flyers past the Red Wings to line up with New York. Pittsburgh, obviously, I'm telling you, they'd have to delay ticket sales by a great amount of time. Because the other night when Pittsburgh was in town, there was a lot of fans there, along with Chicago the next night or the next couple nights later. They just come down or they come out of the woodwork in Columbus and they throw on those jerseys and they invade our territory. So
You
have to be careful with those tickets if there was a draw of Pittsburgh. You talk about a playoff run and the urgency to make the playoffs. This fan base has got to be careful. Do you want to go in the playoffs and get swept? I mean, obviously the playoffs will start next week. You could be done in a week. So the disappointment could just be delayed. You mentioned playoff run. That is what this organization needs, a playoff run. So a good matchup like Pittsburgh, I feel that Pittsburgh, obviously, I hear what you're saying. Now, Pittsburgh would be a better matchup for Columbus in the sense that, you know, they've had guys out of the lineup. They haven't, you know, Fleury had his struggles last year, really all season. It's about the playoffs for him. Is he back to where he was? Is it going to be a mental game? You have those advantages. And you look at Boston, they look like they're just like, when I look at them, they seem like they have not many holes. So I think Pittsburgh would be a better matchup for Columbus just because, you know, they have some issues. They have some underlying issues mentally, starting with Fleury, and injuries are some things that, you know, with Malcolm being out a lot this year, you can go after those things and maybe make a run of it. And that would be even better for Columbus. But, you know, the playoff run is what's important, not just getting in. It's exciting, but that's not all they're trying to do. Because once you're in, that's when the real fun and the real work and the real gut-wrenching roller coaster is on the fans and the players.
Yeah, you don't want to do one and done. But I, to speak to your point, though, like, the electricity that would be in that building with warring factions of Penguins and Blue Jackets fans would be a hell of a thing to see. It would be off the charts. Awesome. Hey, finally, Jody, and thanks for joining us today. What's your take on the Eastern Conference? I mean, are the Bruins an unbeatable juggernaut of a team, or do you think anybody has a chance to take them down?
I think there's a chance to take them down always. I mean, you got to obviously get to Tuukka Rask, Chara, Bergeron. You know, these guys really are the cast of characters that drive what they're doing. And you also look at their fourth line. You have a lot of respect for their fourth line with Campbell and Thornton. And I think Paille is still there. You know, these guys won a cup together. These guys get it done. But I really look at Chara and Rask as the guys you'd have to go to. Obviously, when you get the series, you hone in, you put your plan together. I don't see why not you can take them down. They're obviously the steel shield of this Eastern Conference, but once you get in, I don't even have to say that. There could be some interesting matchups. But for me, they're leading the way. They're pretty dominant, and you see them do it to teams, and they do it. They win in a lot of different ways. They win late. They win early. They win by goaltending, power play, fourth line goalies. They just have that depth that gives them even more confidence. So you definitely have to find a way to knock them off a little bit confidence-wise to get at them.
Good stuff. All right, Jody Shelley, thanks for joining us on the show today.
My pleasure, anytime.
Hopefully you're working well into the postseason, sir, with the Columbus Blue Jackets.
Yeah, well, that'd be great. Thank you.
Take care, man. Jody Shelley, a man who would beat your face with his fists. Always an attribute that I respect in a man. Aaron White writes in, question for you, Greg. Where do you go for advanced stats? It's becoming something interesting to look into, but I was wondering what your go-to place is. I was wanting to look up who the first goal leader was for various teams, but it's a bit of a tough stat to locate amongst the stuff that Google returns. Well, you should be using Yahoo, sir. First goals, actually, I wouldn't consider that to be in the family of advanced stats. It's actually just something you can find on NHL.com. It's if you go to the goals section on NHL.com and check there, you could find first goal, empty net goals, game-winning goals, that kind of thing. But first goal has always just been something that I've been interested in. I find that in a sport where one goal does make a difference as far as what the tone and tenor of a game is and really does set the tone, and all of a sudden one team is playing a different kind of hockey than the other team because they're playing catch-up, all that stuff, the first goal in a game is extraordinarily important. Now, granted, if you score a shit ton of goals, a lot of them are going to be first goals. And so it's no surprise to see Chris Kunitz, Alex Ovechkin, Jamie Benn, and Phil Kessel, and Corey Perry leading the charge for first goals. But then you see things like, you know, you see guys like Jeff Carter, for example. David Krejci, he's got 17 goals. 7 of them have been first goals. Braden Schenn, 7 of his 20 goals this season are first goals. Ditto Sean Monahan. Eric Karlsson, even 6 of his 20 goals have been first goals. It's an interesting stat in the sense that I like guys that set the tone, that get aggressive, that make the first move and then have the opponents have to respond to it. And I think that's essentially what the first goal does. But to answer the other part of your question, Extra Skater is the best advanced stats site on the web. Real-time stats during games and an extensive collection of stats that tell you everything from quality competition to possession stats. It's an amazing site. And really, every situation you can imagine, they can break it down. I still go to Behind the Net for certain stats, like penalties drawn, for example. I'm a big fan of looking at penalties drawn and penalties because it just tells you who maybe sometimes who falls down the best. But overall, Extra Skater is where it's at as far as advanced stats goes. All right, with that, it's time for a Wednesday favorite.
You want to do a mailbag segment every week?
It's time to look deep into the souls of Jeff Merrick and Greg Wyshynski. Not that deep.
We answer your mail.
PuckDaddyBlog at Yahoo.com. On Twitter at Jeff Merrick and at Wyshynski. We're going postal on Merrick versus Wyshynski.
All right. Stuffy nose, loopy headed, Greg Wyshynski. I had like the flu last night. So like I actually was in bed at like 10 with my sneakers on. I worked out and just it was terrible. But I'm feeling better today. But I'm doing juicy thing and cold thing and a little loopy. Max Chans writes in, I like when guys make the first move, #hockey porn. Damn you. Tara Gallant, hey, Wish, I'm going to be in Amsterdam for the first time in September, and I would love to hear what you recommend we see or do. Well, it's a family podcast, so I'll leave it to you to go and see and do certain things. Or you can email me, puckdaddyblog@yahoo.com, and I'll share that info. But from a PG-13 standpoint, I would eat cheese, because the cheese in Amsterdam is ridiculous. And every cheese shop you go to has samples. And I would take a bike and ride through the city. I would suggest doing the bike ride that me and my girlfriend did. Taking your bike and ride to the Van Gogh Museum, which is really an awesome museum. But it's a beautiful city. You can't go wrong with anything that you do there, even if it is illicit and illegal here in the States. Oh, stuffy nose. All right. It's time for the mailbag segment. Nick Leitner writes in, hey guys, Tampa Bay Lightning fan here. We exist. And I'm wondering if either of you think that Andre Palat has a chance to catch McKinnon in the Calder race this year. Thanks, and keep up the excellent work. I don't think so. I think the thing about the balloting, which, by the way, hasn't started yet. I don't know if everybody's privy to that. But the balloting has not actually started yet. The voting hasn't actually started yet for the Professional Hockey Writers Association. I think the inkling is that it's going to happen this weekend. McKinnon, 62 points, 24 goals. Palat, 57 points, 22 goals. There's three factors in Calder voting. The first is, did you lead the league in goals? No. Did you lead the league in points? No. Are you the most famous rookie this season? No. So with that, unfortunately, I would say that Nathan McKinnon has this thing in the bag, especially because, well, because people quite like the Colorado Avalanche this year and would like to reward him. Brad Perella writes in, who's going to hire Peter Laviolette, and how much better does that team become when that happens? Who should not hire Peter Laviolette? Predict the future. It really depends on which teams fire their coach and think they're close, I think. I can't imagine Laviolette going to Nashville, for example, if that's where you're going for. I mean, Brad lives in Nashville. I don't think that's the fit for him. I think he goes someplace where a team thinks they're close. I kind of would love to see him in Washington if Oates gets canned, but I think that would be the hire of a new GM. I don't think I'd like to see him in Toronto, although he's a hell of a coach. I just think that could be combustible. Matt McKenna writes in, hey guys, huge fan of the show. I listen every day at the gym, so much that I forget what music I have on iTunes. I have a suggestion about the current playoff format that I would like to see discussed. Why not let the top seed in each conference select their opponent in the first round? Maybe there's an injury to a netminder or a specific matchup that the team would like to avoid and take advantage of. Better yet, why not let the top seed select all the first round matchups to make things more difficult for the other top contenders? That last thought is, it sounds like almost like a survivor prize. Like you found this idol and you're allowed to do all this matchmaking and games making. That's a very interesting thought. I mean, neither of these things will ever work. The second thought's better than the first. I guess the first is part of the second, but if a team was allowed to pick their opponent for the first round, they would lose every time. Because motivation's a hell of a thing, and the idea that you've picked an opponent because you believe it gives you a competitive advantage because they're weak is essentially like a slap in the face. I would not want to do that to my opponent. That's why you always hear people be very careful with their words before these playoff series, even if they think they have an advantage. No. That would be not a good idea for the top seed, but a really great idea for the lower seed, to be honest with you. Brendan Milhauser writes in, as a fellow Smashing Pumpkins fan, Greg, I want to know what your favorite album and song is by them. Also, do you still follow them? I don't really follow them that much anymore. I bought the last album and it was pretty good. And I saw them in concert a couple years ago at the 930 Club in DC, and it was really good because they played a lot of like deep album cuts from back when they were the Pumpkins. Favorite album, favorite song. I hate to be boring, but my favorite album is Siamese Dream, and my favorite song is Mayonnaise. That's my favorite Pumpkin song. So if you haven't listened to it, download it. I think you'll like it. Patrick Clark. This is two quick questions based on yesterday's officiating conversation. When would you introduce your children to officiating? I started wearing the stripes in college when I stopped playing competitively. I wish I had started much sooner, as I am now a much better skater and smarter player at 29 than I was at 18 or 21. In a short time, I was able to work my way up to work U.S. Hockey Junior B and ACHA college club games, along with district and national development camps for national teams. But I always wondered how far I could have made it if I started earlier. That's a good question. The only referees that I know actually are guys that referee soccer, and they were doing it as kind of a side job, I guess, in high school and things like that. I knew a couple umpires too, so I really don't know if there's a proper age to do it. I don't know, and I also don't know if starting young gives you a better advantage than playing a few years and then making the transition. But it's an interesting thought. I wanted to mention this question only because that conversation we had yesterday was very interesting. I heard from a few people on email talking about, why they would or would not want to become an official and the toughness of trying to recruit officials. So it really is an issue out there at lower levels of hockey. And I hope that guys like Don Van Massenhoven, in their retired years, can maybe be ambassadors and try to get more people encouraged to officiate. Kevin Musial writes in, I'm curious about how many hockey jerseys you two own and how often you wear them. Wish talks about his from time to time. For some reason, I can't imagine Merrick in anything but a suit or gym clothes. I don't know what jerseys Merrick wears. If he has them, I imagine they're probably like obscure junior teams. I've got a decent collection. Nothing crazy. I have a WA Canadiens jersey. I have a Richards Flyers jersey. Three different Devils jerseys, Claude Lemieux and Scott Stevens on the Christmas tree one, a Team Finland jersey, a Stu Grimson Nashville Predators jersey, a Rick Nash Columbus Blue Jackets jersey I have as well. Some of those were gifts and some of those were purchases. How often do I wear them? That's a good question. I still, although I am an older gentleman now, I still do wear hockey jerseys. Obviously, I wear them to games because that is the proper attire. But I also sometimes, living in a city that is not where my team plays, I wear them when I want to troll local fans. Like, for example, when I took my daughter to the farmer's market last Saturday and wore a Devils jersey, knowing that the Devils had thwarted the Washington Capitals, for example. So, for trolling purposes is the answer to your question. And finally, Bobby Gottfried, if you were the president of a team that had just fired everyone, as we could see with the Vancouver, Washington, and Nashville situations, who would be your dream hires as coach and GM? Wow. That's a really great question. If I was going to hire a GM, I would go the assistant route. I would go with a Paul Fenton type or a Jason Botterill type. Botterill's with the Penguins, Fenton's with the Nashville Predators. I like the idea of someone who's kind of sat and learned and absorbed and everything, getting a shot. Moving to the forefront. The Tim Murray situation in Buffalo is a great example of that. Like I like that aspect of the hiring process. I like someone who earned their keep, gets a shot, that kind of thing. Coach, completely contingent on the roster. And again, that's the issue with Tortorella. They hired somebody who doesn't fit the roster. It would depend on who's there. And then we'll go stylistically, what we want to do. And it also depends on if we're close or not close. If we're not close, I might look AHL. Look, assistant coach, somebody younger, somebody who can grow with the team. Todd Richards is a good case in point on that one. But as far as coach goes, I don't know. Someone I can work with, I guess. Someone who's not going to be an asshole. This is all pointing to me not hiring Tortorella, isn't it? Anyways, that is Going Postal for today. That is the show for today. Thank you to Harris and Mooney for joining us to talk about the Canucks. Thank you to Jody Shelley for joining us to talk about the Blue Jackets. Danny McCary writes in, a Devils fan who owns a Flyers jersey, are you sure that's not a jersey foul, pun intended? No, the Flyers jersey actually was from, I think, a promotional package for the Winter Classic they were in, the Fenway one. So, no, I didn't go out and buy the Flyers jersey. So there's that. Anyways, Merrick back tomorrow, so you don't have to put up with me sniffling and whatever. And we will talk to you then. Bye. Oh, thanks to producer Matt. Bye.
Mm-hmm.